Hi, everybody. This is Liz Nord, and you're listening to the No Film School podcast. We all know that getting your first film made is hard. With the added pressure of expectation, getting a second made can be even harder. And then there are the Julie Coens of the world. Coen is a documentary filmmaker who's completed and distributed 8 feature docs and 5 shorts in the past 10 years, and won 3 Emmys along the way. And this is after a prolific career as a producer at NBC, where she produced more than 20 hour-long and 2-hour programs for Dateline. Coen's latest film, available on iTunes now just in time for Veterans Day, is called American Veteran. It tells the story of Army Sergeant Nick Mendez, who was paralyzed from the neck down by a massive improvised explosive device in Afghanistan in 2011 when he was only 21 years old. The film, which follows Mendez through the 5-year period after his injury, was recently certified by the veterans rights group Got Your Six as one of their 6 certified films for fair depiction of veterans. I think you'll really enjoy my wide-ranging discussion with Julie Coen about tips she learned at Dateline that help speed up production, how to reach niche audiences to market your work, and steps for sustaining your career in our unpredictable business. Hi, Julie. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Liz. Thank you so much for having me here.
I'm so glad you're here. We have a lot to talk about today in terms of your long and varied career. So I want to start where we are now and move backwards, especially because this show is happening right around Veterans Day, and your current project is related. So can you talk just a little bit about the current film?
Sure. My current feature doc is called American Veteran. It is the story of a guy who, when he was 21, was in Afghanistan as a soldier for the Army, was paralyzed from the neck down by an IED, and we kind of follow his story from the 5 years following his injury to today. When you hear that, you think, like, wow, that sounds like a super heavy, depressing story. And while it is sobering, I think that Nick, our character, is one of the most upbeat, interesting, fun to be with, kind of both as a human being and as a movie viewer, people that you could want to meet. The story is also a love story. It's about the medical caregiver that he meets in the VA hospital, falls in love with, and spoiler alert, ultimately marries. And so I kind of think, actually, I'm a big love story fan. Like, every film I've made, I think, is a love story in a certain way. I think I wish every story could be a love story. So I guess I always gravitate towards that. So, you know, heavy subject matter, but not, you know, I think the trick of taking a topic like that is trying to make a film that's not unbearable for the viewer. There have been some great films on this subject, on the subject of the veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, some about disabled vets, some about vets with PTSD, many of which are great to watch, some of which are sort of, I'd put in the brilliant but unbearable category. And I was trying to make something really watchable and even fun to watch. I also think all movies should be comedies to a certain extent. So there's some, should be might be a big word. but like, it's great. It's great to find the comedy in anything you can find it in. I'll say that. So I hope I've done a little bit of both of those with this film.
That's so interesting. I don't often hear doc makers thinking of their work as either a love story or a comedy. And you work, you know, you've done some pretty serious subject and some lighter subjects.
Yeah, I've done a bunch of serious subjects. I've made films about classical opera singers from black townships in South Africa. I made a film called The Sturgeon Queens about the sort of 4 generations of the immigrant Jewish family that runs the smoke fish store Russ and Daughters on the Lower East Side. I've made films about, you know, racism. I worked for Dateline NBC for a long time and did crime stories. But, you know, there's just things that you gravitate to in a story, whether it's a book or a fiction narrative film or a doc. And I would say I gravitate towards love and comedy. And even if that's like not what you'd associate with my subject matter, I try to make that part of the film as often as I can.
So in American Veteran, how do you pull out those more like relatable threads in such a tricky topic.
Yes. Well, you know, this was a Verite film where we spent a lot of time, mostly I spent a lot of time, and to a certain extent my field producer, taking turns just going and doing 2 or 3 day visits with our characters, which we did, I think, like 12 or 13 times over the time that we were filming. So, you know, comedy comes up in day-to-day life. My sort of like pro tip is when I'm screening stuff that we've shot, when I'm logging it, and I actually often transcribe stuff myself, but even if it's either me or my film producer transcribed pretty much everything, when I'm going through the transcripts and screening the film, I do a little thing to denote like, oh, this was a great moment, but I also actually have taken to writing LOL in the script. And then as we structure the film together, I actually go back, do a computer search through my transcripts, looking for every LOL, trying to think, can I get this moment in the film?
Wow, that's a great tip. And you're right. I mean, life is funny. That's part of, I guess, why being a documentary filmmaker is interesting.
Definitely. And, you know, part of it, I guess, is the experience that I've had going from someone who was mostly making docs for television to making docs that I'm traveling around with for live screenings, whether it's in festivals or, in the case of my Sturgeon Queens films at JCC's or the current film where we've been bringing to a lot of veterans groups. Like, when you're sitting at a live screening, it's really good to have funny moments in your film. Like, you really feel the audience is in it. Like, it just really makes you realize how important those moments are and how much it's sort of drawing someone into your story if they're laughing along with your characters. So that's when I started this LOL thing.
I love that. Maybe we'll title the podcast How to Make Your Audience LOL with Julie Cohen. So with this, again, with this particular film, what surprised you about the American veteran experience in spending so much time with your subject?
You know, I think I had the same problem that a lot of civilians have vis-a-vis the military and vets, experiences that I really didn't know that much about because I've done a number of stories on that subject, both as a news person and a doc person, but in like my personal life, I don't have a lot of combat veteran friends, although I've made some in the course of making this movie, but I guess I sort of had the tendency that I think a lot of people have to sort of go in a stereotypical direction of thinking of someone as either being superhero, like, oh my God, so patriotic and brave and is like jumping on grenades and is like the best, most superhuman person you ever met. That's like one end of the spectrum. Or the stereotype that veterans themselves dislike the most, which is, you know, broken, incapacitated, unable to carry on with life. And, you know, here is Nick, the star of this film, and he'd like me saying that because he said he wanted me to make him a movie star, so I'm sort of doing the best I can with that, who is like neither of those things. He's not a hero. He doesn't see himself as a great patriot. He joined the army because it seemed like the best career move for him at the time, and in a lot of ways he was right about that. You know, nor is he broken and finished. Like, yes, he doesn't have much use of his arms or legs, but he's managed to build a pretty incredible life. He has a great time. He's super active. He learned how to do a lot of things that he didn't know how to do. You know, things you might not think you could do with your mouth, like playing video games and fishing, both of which he does in the film. Like, just started learning this is my situation. Where do I go from here? Which, of course, you know, you're always sort of looking for metaphors when you're making a documentary. That's like the metaphor for all of us. We have situations, you have disadvantages, you have obstacles that are in your way. Like, you could get completely stuck in them, or you can think like, how do I move forward? How can things be as good as possible given what the obstacles and limitations are? You know, I said to him a few times during making, it would come up like, wow, you know, Nick, you've got such a great attitude. And his answer to that was like, I've always had a great attitude. You know, people used to say that to me when I was a kid also. He didn't have the easiest life. His family had a pretty tough time. They didn't have very much money. He got kicked out of school for smoking pot, for high school. You know, like, things were kind of going badly, and, you know, so, sometimes of his own making, sometimes because of his circumstances, but, like, he kind of figured out ways to make the best of things. That's just kind of his way. Not that he was never bothered or depressed by being paralyzed. He was, but he kind of figured out how to get through that and how to make his life as good as it can be. And right now it's, like, pretty good.
Yeah, I think people will be, you know, surprised when they see the film, because of all of the elements that you talked about. It's I feel like a lot of documentary filmmakers are trying to subvert certain stereotypes, you know, in their work, or make a universal story out of something specific, and it applies here.
I think whenever you really get to know someone, stereotypes just fall away, whether that's what we might assume about each other because of race or gender or religion or age. Like, you have these things in your mind about what it is to have someone else's life, but then once you're in a mode of really spending time with someone the way you are when you're making a Verite doc, or even, you know, spending an hour and 15 minutes in a movie where it's been kind of curated down, like, you're like, oh, you know what, that person is an individual, and, like, their life isn't exactly what I expected it to be. And, you know, that's why it's really fun to do the work we do, and why it's fun, I think, also why it's fun and illuminating to watch docs. I mean, I like watching documentaries probably more than I like making them. It's a lot easier.
that is for sure.
And, you know, but it is kind of my, like, I love a true story.
Yeah. So taking a step back into your broader career, you mentioned your sort of coming up in television. So talk a little bit about that background, and also what you then brought from it into independent producing.
Yeah, well, I worked in TV news and storytelling for quite a while, both at Court TV, actually, where I started my career, right around the corner from where we're recording this right now, telling crime stories and trial stories, and then for Dateline NBC, where I was a producer, doing almost exclusively long form, like 1 and 2 hour, some news stories, some pop culture stories, but almost all crime stories. And, you know, the kind of crime stories that Dateline is so great at, many of which have to do with spouses killing one another, frankly, which is, as someone, when you're writing and producing that material, really, really hard material, like much more difficult and depressing, spending time kind of living in those stories than it was in the veteran story. So that's just one, you know, when there's hatred and bitterness and criminal mischief and brutality like that, you know, that's a hard thing to spend time with.
And I imagine harder to find those love and comedic moments that you gravitate towards.
Yes, although, you know, certainly you could find some of that. There was some, you could usually, most people have some humor in their lives or some love in their life. I really feel like the basic storytelling process is pretty much the same. The reason that I left NBC to do other things, and specifically to make docs, was I kind of wanted to take the skills I developed for storytelling and apply it to the kind of stories that I really felt like I wanted to tell. You know, true crime has gotten so huge, you know, as with a whole new audience recently.
Which I'll mention, it's funny that we're recording in Midtown Manhattan right now, and there's a police siren in the background, appropriately. So which skills do you think you really sharpened having to turn things around for television?
Yeah, you know, I think TV news producing is a really, really good background for documentary filmmaking. I have a number of other friends who've taken the same path that I have, and I just think it helps because it kind of frees up your sense of what is possible in a very short time. You know, when I first got into the doc world, I was in a situation where an executive person found out a deadline had been moved up and was like, oh my God, you know, all we have is like a radio cut and now our film has to be on the air in 2 months versus like in 2.5 months. Like, can we do that? I'm like, are you kidding? Like, we could put this on next week if we had to. Like, you could, you know, you can, if you need to put an hour on in a day, like it seems impossible, but it can be done. I've seen it done and I've been part of making it happen. So I actually feel like those skills are really helpful. And just, you know, the skill of telling a story and wanting to make sure that your audience stays with it. In network TV world, some people are going to be tracking your ratings minute by minutes, as it's called. So like the obsession with keeping people interested, you know, I think that can be taken too far. But I also think it's, as a viewer of things, I think it's good. Like, I want to feel like the author of a work, like the filmmaker, is trying to keep me interested. Like, I've seen films where it didn't seem like they were trying that hard. And, you know, I'm a fan of accessible art. I don't like docs that are so rambling that you're like, okay, what's even the point here? I get that it's artistry or it's beautiful, but it's not, you know, I mean, the best films are really riveting and you really care what happens next. I mean, look at, you know, the one film everyone's talking about now that I just saw last weekend, Jane. Like, you know, like you're sort of in it every minute. You're wanting to know like what her relationship is going to be like with the monkeys, and you're wanting to see what is going to happen in her, what's going to happen for her career, how that's going to be taken, how's the love story unfolding. There's comedy and romance, and in that, it's just like you sort of feel like you're in the hands of someone who's trying to shape something in such a way that you'll find interesting. Like, he could have just, apparently, I forget, was there 140 hours worth of monkey and lady footage that he had? He could have just like thrown a whole bunch of stuff, but no, he shaped it to make it really work for the viewer, and I appreciate that.
And just to contextualize for our listeners, this is a new film by Brett Morgan where he had all sorts of hours and hours of archival footage of Jane Goodall, and then was granted this footage and tied it together with an interview, a modern
yes,
interview with
exactly,
her.
Exactly.
But created a story with it. So
right.
I haven't seen it yet, but I'm
yes,
really
yeah,
eager
it's
to.
Definitely, yeah.
So what are some tactics that you develop to make sure that you are keeping people hooked throughout? Do you do lots of work in progress screenings, or how do you know?
I have not been a big work in progress screening person. I do show stuff, although more recently I did that and found it quite effective. I certainly show stuff to my husband from time to time. I try to like step back from it and think and come to it like an outsider, which I feel like is something I'm capable of doing, although you can never do it thoroughly. It's worth always showing something to a few trusted people who don't know the story too well, who'll be like, oh, wait a second, that was his uncle? Like, I thought that was his stepfather. You know, it's like you things that you just aren't going to get in your own project when you know the story so well. You know, one trick I guess I try to do is to, when you have a number of characters, is to kind of, as you're shooting a verite thing, to sort of start seeing what characteristics you're finding in characters and then try to shoot and edit for that. Like, I actually, especially in a multi-character story, I try to, I'll like write down little character sketches of the various people, like, oh, this is the shy one who's a little bit nervous and isn't quite sure if she's good enough to you know, cross these hurdles. And, you know, this character is like brash and comedy. Like, as I'm seeing that, as I'm getting to know, because everyone is such a complicated mishmash of characteristics. But see what you're shooting, look at your footage, see how the people kind of seem to you. And then I've even told both my, if I'm shooting stuff myself, I just tell myself, but if I'm working with a crew, I tell my camera crew that, like, oh, you know, we really noticed that this violinist, I'm just thinking of an example of something I did about the Budapest Orchestra a few years ago, this violinist is really shy and nervous, like, make sure you're filming for that. Like, in moments where she's nervous, make sure we're rolling and catching that, because that's, you know, I'm not making up stuff about the people. I'm waiting till we've shot a little to find what I'm seeing, but then, you know, we're sort of choosing for that so that to help the, guide the viewer through that. And, you know, you're wanting your characters to kind of evolve through the course of a story. So, you know, you help that out in the editing process. Like, someone you're emphasizing, maybe you're emphasizing their timidness at the beginning, and then there's a big moment where they kind of come out on stage and suddenly they're shining brightly. Like, you're trying to show how that really happened and catch every moment where that happened and edit for every moment of that happening.
Yeah, it makes sense. And you hope that people are going to surprise you, I guess. Another question about that transition from the news world, the Dateline world, to the feature world. You mentioned that there are, like, the timelines are pretty different. And that's sort of amazing because, you know, now suddenly you have all the time in the world. But, of course, you can't take it because you also have to make a living.
Right.
But what are some of the kind of time-saving shortcuts that you learned when you were out in the field for Dateline?
Well, you know, I think the big piece of advice that carried over so well from when I was doing things on a really strict timeline to when I have a little more freedom, but it'd be better to stay on the strict timeline anyway, is to not hide from your own footage, to not be afraid of, you know, there's a, it's so intimidating for there's so many stages to the process that, like, if you've really thought through how terrifying they are, you wouldn't get out of bed in the morning. But you know, one is just the moving forward with doing something. But then once you're out there shooting, I feel like you're always kind of worrying to yourself, like, okay, do I have a story? And what is the story here? And, like, I really, especially if it's a Verite thing, try to go out of my way to be watching the footage and kind of living with it as soon as possible, just so I can start organizing and thinking to myself, you know, because I think the thing that keeps one from doing that is the fear of, like, oh my God, what if there's not a story there? But, like, once you watch it, I feel like I'm almost always really pleasantly surprised, like, oh, look, there is that story, and I didn't even know that. Or things that you were in the room when they happened, or even if you were literally operating the cameras, as I did a lot with American Veteran, like, oh, I totally didn't notice something that happened when I was sitting right there. And then I watch it, I always feel like I get to know the characters so much better in, you know, screening the footage and in the edit room than I ever did when I was in their presence, which is a weird thing about life. Like, maybe we would all know each other better if we were running around making documentaries about each other all day. But you know, I feel like having that experience of sort of trying to shape little pieces of the story from early on is what I learned to do at NBC and what I'm still doing now. Like, there wasn't really the luxury of, like, oh, we're gonna go out and be filming for this long, long period of time before we start worrying about editing. Like, we were starting to script, like, pretty early on after shooting, and I think that helps move things more quickly. And then it gets you to a place where, as you do later interviews and as you do later shooting, you kind of know a little bit more what you need, and you don't have to go crazy shooting everything. Like, you make a list of things that really have to get covered, or transitions if you're not working with a, you know, if there's no narration, which most of my recent films haven't been narrated films. But you know, that there's certain things you're going to need, like, transitions have to happen. So you try to make sure you know what you need so that then you can make sure that it happens.
Okay. So talking about your broad swath of work, you know, you've already mentioned several of the topics that you've covered. And I think with any doc person, I mean, you often people will find themselves in some sort of like topic area. So maybe they don't have to start from scratch each time, but most of the time, we're all starting from scratch each time, and you really are jumping from these topics that have very little relationship to each other. So do you approach every film sort of the same way or completely new? Like, how do you get into a new project?
Yeah, you know, often I read a book. Like, I feel like that's kind of a, like, the good thing about making a documentary versus maybe my husband has written a bunch of nonfiction books, and I feel like to write a nonfiction book about something, you really have to know so much. To make a doc, you don't need to know as much. You need to know something, but you can plunge in without knowing too much. But I actually do feel like there's some, you know, it helps to ground you to, like, know a little bit at least. You know, the first, after I left NBC, the first doc I made was for WNET, the New York PBS station, had me do the 2-hour companion piece to Ken Burns's The War series about World War II. I did basically a New York version of that story called New York Goes to War. And I was like, you know what? Like, I'm sure I read some stuff about World War II in elementary school, in high school too, maybe. I never took a college course that covered it. I was like, I really don't know that much about World War II. I'm going to make a 2-hour documentary about this, like, but that has a script that I'm writing. So I just, like, you know, went to Amazon and ordered actually a very good book by a professor that was called The Story of World War II, like a 700-page book that was sort of a combination of narrative but with lots of sort of first-person accounts. And it really went through the whole chronology of the war and gave me the basics on, like, okay, this is what was going on in Europe, and this is what was happening in the Pacific, and this is what the Battle of the Bulge was. Like, I forever hate everyone that uses every local news person that uses the Battle of the Bulge as, like, a, you know, a stupid headline for a dieting story. Like, once you read what the Battle of the Bulge really is, like shut up with that. Yeah, totally not cute. But you know, and I actually felt like, I mean, maybe that sounds kind of like surfacey to be like, oh, well, she read one book about it, but at least it was something. I mean, you got to start somewhere. And I felt like that was enough. And then since then, that's sort of been my, like, habit when I'm doing a new subject matter. Like, I read one book and then I start to, I pick out a good book. It seems like it's on track. And I mean, actually, the American veteran and Iraq and Afghanistan situation was actually a little different because I had read several books on the subject matter by the time I started, and I had done, you know, aside from making docs, I do a bunch of freelance news work, and even going back to when I was at NBC, had done a bunch of stories about veterans and about military, and actually had always thought, like, oh, I really want to make a feature doc about this, partly because it is a subject that civilians are kind of afraid of and don't want to touch. And I just sort of feel like, you know, we as a society actually need to think about this. Like, it's sort of, and kind of those of us who have storytelling skills, like, okay, that's something that we should be trying to tell stories about. People have done it before, and I feel like people should keep doing it. I hope it's not the last film that I make about veterans, frankly. And, you know, I like to see work that other people have done on that subject. And I just think it's something that's good to tell stories about. So I didn't know something about that, but, you know, swing dancers in the 1940s, like, I think I read a book that dealt with that when I was making some films on that subject. So, you know, did a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
Well, you referred to PBS coming to you for the first film, your first film out of the gate as an independent, and then sounds like, and that was a while ago, and it sounds like American Veteran came from your heart, your interest area. So yes. What's the sort of breakdown? How many of your projects come to you, and how many do you come to?
Yeah, I'd say it's been somewhere around half and half, but I'm trying to move more in the direction of films that I want to make. I kind of have my work life and my teeny production company, which is me and one other full-time person, and then just other freelancers as things require. I kind of try to make that breakdown between projects that are the things I really want to do and projects that are helping bring in income. And I try not to force those things to mix, because that's just a recipe for unhappiness. Like, I've done all kinds of projects just because they seem like they're going to bring in some money, and we all need money. than I have. When I'm doing those kind of projects, I'm working really hard at them. I'm bringing whatever skills and creativity I have. I'm trying to keep the client really happy, but I'm not thinking like, oh, this is like the great passion of my heart. Like, no, this is how we're trying to pay the rent check. Then there's the projects that I'm really like dream of doing, like the Sturgeon Queens, my smoked fish movie, or like American Veteran. And those are like, okay, I really want to make this movie. I'm going to try to figure out how we can like not go into like heavy debt on it, but I'm not necessarily thinking that this is going to be like a great windfall. Like, I think some documentary filmmakers make the mistake of thinking that they're going to get rich making documentaries. It's not like, it's just like, that's very hard for that to happen.
Yeah.
And I think your life is better if you're not even trying. Like, that's not really what I'm going for, even. Like, I'm trying to make the films that, you know, some little projects I'd like to make. And at the same time, I'm trying to do some things that will also bring in some money so that I'm able to do other things. And if not every project is going to, you know, or to this point, no project is going to sort of serve both functions. Like, oh, I made all this money, and also it was like exactly what I dreamed of. Like, that's not quite how the world works, but that's fine. Like,
and it can still be a goal.
It can still be a goal. Absolutely.
But it seems as though PBS is involved on either end. Sometimes they're coming to you. Sometimes you're showing, you know, you've had the good fortune of showing your independent work that was generated by you on PBS, and I think for a lot of doc filmmakers, we understand that PBS still is a place that, you know, is one of the few places in the U.S. that broadcasts docs, but it feels quite hard to reach, and yet you have this long relationship with them. So can you talk a little bit about, I guess, what you'd call the PBS system and what working within that is like?
Yeah, you know, I can't even pretend to thoroughly understand the PBS system. I mean, like a lot of things in business world, it has to do with personal relationships. I know Neil Shapiro, the president of the New York PBS station, from when he was the executive producer of Dateline. So truthfully, in terms of getting things picked up for air on PBS, I mean, one thing that one needs to understand about that is that there's not necessarily a big pot of money with which they're acquiring films. Not to say that they have, you know, some of the big series don't pay something, but even that is not that much for a film that exists. If a film's pretty good, you have relationships that I have that you can get somebody to look at it and consider it and get it on the air, that can happen. But these are, in terms of things that are my personal work, these are films that I've gotten funding for, that I've gone out and done what you do, whether it's foundation grants, I've done a bunch of those, whether it's crowdfunding, I've done that before, whether it's going to various individual contributors. I've done everything that I've tried pretty much everything you can do to fund a film, a lot of it successfully, like more failures than successes when you try. But if you're motivated enough, eventually you'll come up with a way to pay for the movie. But like, once, you know, so it's not like this great thing of like, oh, I'm going to PBS with like a concept and they're saying like, great, we'll fund that and it gets on the air. That hasn't happened to me. They've come to me and said, okay, we want a like that New York Goes to War film, like, oh, we need we want a 2-hour film on the New York City experience as it relates to World War II. The reason that I got that assignment was my experience in news, because they're like, we need a 2-hour doc and we've got about 3.5 months to make it. Most documentary filmmakers would be like, oh my God, what are you talking about? Where I was like, oh, 3.5 months, like, that's so much time. Great. So those commission projects, they have come to me, but if it's something that's like my own passion projects, I have not yet figured out how to get something paid for, in advance, at least through the PBS, system. But I've had the great good fortune for New York PBS and a number of other PBS stations to air, films that I've made. So that's good.
We all want the magic bullet or whatever, but it just doesn't quite exist. So when we first started talking about having you on the show, you had mentioned this idea of niche filmmaking. And I think, you know, for folks that have now been listening to us for the last half an hour, they'll get some sense of what that means in your context. But how would you describe niche filmmaking?
Yeah, you know, I don't feel that making that niche filmmaking, there's no such thing as niche filmmaking from the making of the film perspective. There's niche marketing. And there's like going out there for a niche audience, which I've kind of gone out of my way to try to do that, because after all, you're trying to get your film out there in the world to people who would be interested in seeing it. And in the case of Sturgeon Queens, my film, which had two niche audiences, the Jewish niche audience and the food niche audience. And both of those niches in the documentary world are pretty serious. I had no idea when I made that film how many Jewish film festivals there are, but there are, you know, more than 100. I mean, you know, because you've made a niche Jewish film yourself. So that was great. It also had the, just from the really practical perspective, the Jewish film festival circuit, which is big, it's quite well organized, and unlike a lot of festivals, which are like free-floating organizations that are barely, you know, that are so on a shoestring, most of the Jewish film festivals are affiliated with their local JCC. So there's actually a staff that works at the place, and most of them will pay not a huge fee, but will pay a fee of a few hundred dollars to screen your film, and like that helps. I mean, you know, I made a decision that, like, you know, this is my audience, and also they're quite, you know, the Jewish film festivals are really well attended, and, you know, you get really a great crowd of film enthusiasts going to them. So
passionate audiences.
Yeah, really passionate audiences. So started submitting that film to a few Jewish film festivals. Once a couple of them took it, it got fairly easily, the word kind of spread, and it got picked up other places, and then I got a distributor through that. And I felt like that whole experience went really well and kind of got my film out there to the audiences that were gonna love it the most. So that felt like a good experience to me. And so I'd say I did something a little bit similar even with American Veteran, because there is a world of military film enthusiasts. There is a GI film festival. There's actually more than one where my film screened and actually won a good award there, their Founders Choice Award. And that got the interest of a number of different, like the New York City Veteran Services got in touch with me and started doing screenings. I'm now have hooked up with the Elizabeth Dole Foundation, Hidden Heroes, Military Caregivers. They're doing screenings in a bunch of places. In that case, you know, I really kind of think of that as like a worthwhile thing to do. I haven't asked them for any screening fees or anything, but I feel like it like gets the word out in the community. And then we have a the film got picked up by Freestyle Digital Media. That's distributing it starting now. When this airs. Which is an LA-based distribution company that just happens to have an interest because a couple of their main acquisitions person just happens to think military stuff is an important issue. So she's gone out of her way to acquire some military-themed films, and she found me. My advice and my rule of thumb about distribution, this is also kind of true about media and about festivals too, is to like, I'm much more interested in doing business with people that are interested in me than trying to push myself on people who don't want me. There are distributors out there. I have, in the past, I've tried to get people interested, like, oh, such and such a distributor, like, oh, this would be great for you. And like, I just find it hard to break through. Whereas the people that come to me are the ones who are really, who seem like they're the most interested. And that's, you know, I mean, it's, you have to be in a pretty good position actually for people to come to you, first of all. So that's great. But, you know, I was very psyched at this film. You know, I had a few different distribution offers and ended up deciding I wanted to work with Freestyle because they seemed like they were super enthusiastic about military and veteran themed films for the same reason that I wanted to make the film. They want to distribute it. So.
And to your overall point, I'll often say this kind of thing to younger filmmakers who are frustrated that they're not getting recognized by Sundance. And it's like, well, you know, most people aren't. But can you find a festival or an outlet that, you know, has already an audience that's interested in what your film is about? And suddenly you can make a lot bigger wave than you ever could have as an unknown at Sundance.
Exactly.
In the first place.
I mean, I've been making films for a long time. Maybe at the very beginning I might have submitted to Sundance, then I kind of didn't for a while, just certainly didn't submit this film. It didn't seem like, you know, I went out of my way for American Veteran to submit the film to festivals that seemed like they had a pretty heavy social, you know, social issue, wanting inspirational films component. An example of that would be Heartland Film Festival in Indianapolis, where we just screened a couple weeks ago. I had noticed that they seemed to, you know, they're a pretty big established festival, and they seem to have they really want issue films that mean something and inspire and that sort of thing. So I submitted there. We're going to the Virginia Film Festival coming this week. I think we've been about like 25 festivals, but like most of them, either they really like social issues, either they're military oriented, or maybe I know someone there, or there is a geographic connection between a character and the film. We had a main character from Kansas City, so I submitted to and got into the Kansas City Film Festival. We had a veterans group that builds homes for disabled vets that's based right near Providence, Rhode Island. So I submitted and got into the Rhode Island Film Festival. And when I submit, I write them this long letter saying like, oh, and this is you, this is the group, Homes for Our Troops, they're right near you, they'd all come, whatever, and they did. And I mean, that whole, you know, it's not easy getting into festivals, but I'd say I was batting about 500, if that's at the, I think I got into about half of the festivals that I submitted to for this. So that seems like a pretty good, seemed like a pretty good average, but I targeted it pretty closely to, there had to be some real connection between my film and what the festival, is all about. You know, if you have a film that's like a lot more commercial or that has access to a celebrity that everybody cares about, then you're in a different different position. But just like, you know, I try to be realistic and think like, oh, what does this festival think it's about, and what do they want, and go in that direction.
Well, it sounds like the niche audience approach could benefit your film in a lot of ways. So what are some other ways, if someone's working on a film and they feel like they have a niche audience for it, or a niche audience to just start the wave for the film, what are some other ways besides festivals that you might suggest, you know, reaching out to that niche or connecting with that
Yes.
niche?
Yes, I mean, the beauty of the current social media world, you know, start connecting with your potential audience online. I totally did that for American Veteran. We're going to see how that all connects when, as the film right now goes into digital distribution. My field producer editor, Nadine Nator, made us a minute and 10 second social media Facebook video, the kind you see that's like streamed on Facebook, that just, you know, basically tells the story in a minute and change. There's music to it, but it's not about the sound and sound bites. It's just like there's text on screen that tells you what's going on. It's beautiful moving images. It seemed to me to be the kind of inspiring story that I'd seen a fair number of viral social media videos on military themes, also disability themes. So I tried it and put it out there. We've gotten more than 10 million views.
Wow.
of our social media video between the various places. I also tried to get it out there to Facebook pages that specialize in feel good in Feel Good Videos. One of them was called Love What Matters, and they picked it up, and you know, all that I required, they actually recut it a little bit. I'm like, that's great, but just put something somewhere that, you know, connects it back. They put something in the comment section, not in the main body, because that messes up Facebook algorithms. There's a whole lot of interesting stuff, but you know, what does that do for the film? I'm not entirely sure, but it didn't seem like a bad idea. And, you know, all of a sudden we have, you know, we put the film before the film even really comes out where most people can see it. I've got a Facebook page where we've got 4,600, you know, likes and fans. And, you know, so I think there is a niche audience for most films. You know, there's you know, if you're making a film, you know who it's going to appeal to. And I think trying to connect with those people early and like let them be aware of your film is a good idea. The downside is you start getting barraged by emails like, how can I see this in Knoxville, Tennessee? And the answer is kind of like, you can't. But like,
you can,
you know, now, exactly. So now, so I have kept track of all those people. And now as we get ready for our digital distribution to start, I mean, I'm going to see what happens when I email them all the link. Will they all go on and buy it? I don't know. I hope so.
Yeah, but it's, you know, you're in a better position than the film going up online and not having anybody to reach out to.
Exactly.
You know, you've built this
exactly. And
audience.
Truthfully, it seemed to mean something to my distributor and to their, they have salespeople who are trying to get it onto different platforms and are trying to get it good placement on those platforms. And, you know, my understanding from them is I'm going to be on video on demand on, you know, Time Warner, Cox, like
all
Cablevision, like all the major cable places have taken it. That now it's not free on those platforms, as well as Amazon, iTunes, you know, that kind of thing. And Xbox, even, like, who knew that Xbox you can buy movies on? But there's a whole video gaming subplot of my film. So apparently people are going to be able to watch the film off of Xbox if they pay, you know, $3.99 or whatever it is to rent it. But I mean, it's a complicated world out there. There are people on the business side who thoroughly understand it. Your audience as filmmakers, just like me, don't really need to understand it thoroughly. All you need to know is, like, there's stuff going on out there. So try to hook yourself into it, because, you know, we have a common interest here in trying to, you know, you're making, the reason we make movies is for people to watch them.
Right.
So and truthfully, festival audiences, while it's great to sit in a festival with a lot of other people, like, you know, that's not, you're not talking about a huge number of people, you know, you're talking about a few hundreds of people here and there. So you really want to figure out how to break through all the noise and get people watching it, whether it's on TV or digitally or on when you're playing video games on Xbox,
like, sure,
or on your phone or wherever, like,
yeah. So final piece of advice, just in terms of, again, this career longevity piece that you've actually completed and distributed more docs than most doc people I know, who will take several years for each project. And, you know, you still seem to have the energy to keep doing it and keep putting out films. So what overall words do you have to share about keeping that enthusiasm up and making sure that you always have projects sort of rolling?
Right. I mean, you know, I guess I know a number of people who've made docs, even, frankly, docs that have been more successful than mine have, but that have given up pretty quickly because, like, it's exhausting. Like, it feels like such an ordeal to, like, start each project and to get it going and get someone to pay for it. And, like, all through it, there's the voices of doubt in your head that are like, you know, you're going through all this work and you're like, but is, like, I don't even know if it's going to be good. Because, of course, when you make a documentary, you don't know, you can't really know going into it that it's going to be good. You have to sort of head fake yourself into some kind of space of positivity, the same voice that you would use when you're talking, when you're pitching to a funder or to a distributor or a platform, of like, oh, it's going to be great, it's going to be genius. But really, like, you have to use that to turn that voice back around to yourself. And when you leave that meeting, tell yourself, like, you know, I don't know for sure, but, like, I think we can do this here. Like, this could be good. So, like, you know, I mean, there's, like, I actually feel like all of the, I'm an adjunct at Columbia J School also. And whenever I'm dealing with in the doc program, I sometimes advise, you know, some of the teams that are putting together, docs. And I feel like that job is, a lot of it is sort of like psychological, like it's all kind of therapy. And I guess the advice I would give someone that's working on making a film or has sort of made two and is then just like trying to get themselves going to make the third is just to, is all kind of psychological. It's like, you know, try to give yourself a little bit of encouragement, try to give yourself a break, try to figure out like, there's a lot of joy in the doing of it, even if it doesn't work out perfectly. Like there's a real joy in the kind of getting to know the characters and the access you can get to other people's lives and just the perspective you get on the world just from doing the work that we do, never mind whether the film ever gets out. So, you know, there's the, I think maybe cliche-ish Wayne Gretzky, quote of like, you know, you miss 100% of the shots you don't try. And I think like giving yourself that message again and again as a documentary filmmaker, like, I don't know if this is going to work out, but like, if I don't start trying to get the money for it, if I don't start shooting, if I don't start looking at the stuff and editing, like if I don't, at each stage of the process, if you don't move forward, then it's definitely not going to work out. Like, so giving yourself like some credit and a pat on the back for getting as far as you get each time and giving yourself a break for your failures. And just like, that's all part of the experience of life. And then we're moving on. I feel like this is getting very philosophical for a practical filmmaker advice. But I, you know, I think the psychology of it is just like, you know, trying to move forward. Like at every stage, trying to move forward, acknowledging to yourself that it's really not that easy. Like, I think people are sometimes get a little flummoxed when they realize how hard parts of this process are, and try to take from it the parts of it that are really valuable, kind of leaving aside outcomes. And if you can kind of keep moving positively through all that, then you'll get up and do, you know, I think, it depends how I count it, but I've made something like 12 films at this point. And like, you know, I'm going through the stage now. I mean, there's one after American Veteran that we're just finishing editing now. And now I'm looking into what's the next one. And you're like, oh my God, I have to do this again. And the funding and the whatever and the getting booking and the characters. And what about, you know, but like, I don't know. Let's go. This is what I do. So let's move forward and do the next one.
Well, I personally find that very inspiring, and I'm sure our listeners will too. So thank you so much.
Thank you. This is really fun.
Thank you for listening. Cohen's film American Veteran is available on cable VOD and digital, and you can learn about some of her other projects at betterthanfiction.tv. You can hear lots of other fascinating conversations on the art of filmmaking by finding the No Film School podcast in iTunes. Make sure to subscribe there or on your favorite podcast app so that you can catch our Indie Film Weekly News Show, which comes out every Thursday morning and fills you in on everything you might have missed when you were busy making films. Meanwhile, stay in touch. You can reach me on Twitter at LizFilm, and we are on Twitter at NoFilmSchool. See you on Thursday.